Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Hey, can we get pins made? And Chris Roberts would love this. It would be that dude in like the really dark hoodie sitting over a computer. He would go nuts. Are you kidding me? He hates that mantra of the person sitting over it. But I just hired a lady to create a logo for me to put on a coffee. And when she said, what do you want to be on the logo? And I said, well, your runner's high has this guy running, right? What if you had a guy standing there going halt, and he's putting his hand up to a large dam holding back water. And in that water is some really weird computer code and Bitcoin and other things. And you're plugging a hole in the dam. You're stopping a breach of water, right? And she goes, what would you call it? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, because she goes, when I think of cybersecurity, she goes, I think of like a guy in like a hoodie. And I was like, no, don't yeah, do it.
Don't go there.
I'm like, you might as well go ahead and make it a dark roast.
Well, that was one of the things that we covered, right? In one of our podcasts. And who are you really worried about? And that person, don't you remember, that person probably does exist, because there is somebody that looks, you know, I've got the dark hoodie and I'm sitting in my parents' basement going away at a computer. But by and large, that's not what we're all worried about.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone has seen Jacobetz riding around in his Lamborghini, standing outside talking to the police in the middle of St. Petersburg, he ain't wearing a dark hoodie. I mean, that's right. Like a full Gucci jumpsuit, man.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting. My wife actually threw this out, that so many cyber's become such a prominent topic now that you see it in a lot of movies, right? I mean, granted, there's some historical hacker movies in the past, but I feel like you're seeing it more and more, and that might be an opportunity to, we're going to go through, is it real or fiction? Right.
Oh, there is. So I'll find the links. There's MovieOS. There's a whole blog spot, which I guess tells you when it started, on analysis of the screens from technology in movies. Hilarious. So like, this is just doing basic, you know, it's basically hello world repeated 100 times.
Right.
Should today's topic be movies relate? Like, I mean, I could start with sneakers. Like, I loved, and Robert Redford, like, loved the guy.
You just touched the hearts of every security person,
right? And there. Not my wife, is she can't stand the movie Sneakers.
Really?
I can't figure out why. To me, I just watched it probably 4 nights ago. Such a great movie.
Love that movie. And then the tea party.
It's a tea party. Here's your tea party, bish.
Like, that was one of those movies that if you watched it even at a young age, you were like, this is so cool, right?
Well, it's the deduction. It walks you through how you solve a problem. You solve a problem using senses, you solve a problem using tech. They didn't break out hard tech for just about anything. Right. It was all, you know, old school tools, reliable things, things that you have around you, and some wiretapping. but the, you know, the idea is that security, maybe this is what resonates so heavily, is that security is not about tech and tools. Security is not about tech. It's about using the things you have to try and deduce. It's sleuthing, it's discovery, it's detective work. And that was what was really interesting to me. Before you came on, Brian, Eric and I were talking about, you know, the drive, what it is that drives security people. And we're the ones that we've been talking to somebody who's like, yeah, I don't understand why you guys do what you do. And the answer is, because of the feeling of being able to deduce those things and that innate desire to walk into the fire as opposed to away from the fire. But for me, it's just that endorphin of I've solved this. It's, you know, that Sherlock Holmes moment.
Right. Well, you hit on a really good point, Dan, too, about the, because I think there's a misconception. A lot of people going into security go, oh, I want to be a hacker, right? I want to break things. That's all well and good. But once they start getting into the process, realize, oh, wait, I got to do a lot of work up front before I get to that short stint where you actually break into something. And that's like the reconnaissance phase, right? It's so key to everything it's done. And all that is probing, researching, finding things out. It takes a long time to do it right. And, you know, drawing that back to the movies, I feel like you miss that in a lot of the movies. You know, I remember, what was that? I think it was Swordfish. Wasn't that the one where they were trying to, yeah.
Sorry, that one evokes a visceral response similar to my wife and sneakers, but continue.
It was horrible because if I remember correctly, they were trying to break some encryption and then you had some 3D objects connecting different pieces and stuff like that. And yeah, security's not like that at all. I mean,
yeah, the only way to try to show that it was really difficult was they have these cubes that
right.
were three-dimensional and you're getting one to connect to the next one, right? At the end of the day, maybe that was trying to be the representation of thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of lines of code, you know, that people, you know, when you're looking at logs and everything else that maybe you have to scrape through. And now people have built tools to be able to scrape through that and look for certain things, et cetera. But yeah, I don't know that I put Swordfish up there at the top.
No, not at all. Well, it doesn't sell. It's not sexy that, oh, I'm running Hashcat. All right, hold on. What percentage are we at? Okay, we haven't cracked it yet. Hold on, I'll come back. What percentage are we at now? And it's a waiting game, right? That doesn't sell. That doesn't look good in a movie. But on the flip side, you take Mr. Robot, was phenomenal. It got a little odd at the end. I think a lot of shows now are
when ratings need to be maintained.
Yeah. But if you go through some of the code that actually ran on the screens, like there was a lot of Metasploit. You could pinpoint the tool that was being used there and it was legitimate. It was pretty solid.
That's interesting. Cause I wouldn't have known that back then watching it. Right. Cause I didn't have that background in security, but I think, what was the movie that I was thinking of? It was more recent after that. This is going to come to me because I look back, you had, when we talked about sneakers, you go back to the original Hackers with Angelina Jolie and they're riding around on skateboards with the colored hair. Oh, I know what it was. Black Hat. Mm. And they, a lot of people say, oh, I didn't like that movie. When I bring that up, but what I liked about the movie, what they tie into it is that in the end, it was really about money, right? It was about being able to move a market, right? If you could shut something down, right? So like, if you shut down this facility, you could play options on the energy or the water or this, right? And you could do that to an entire country. You look at what happened with coronavirus when it first came out. If somebody, like I didn't even say this jokingly, but in the first month of shutdown, I said, well, I go back and follow the money, right? If anybody was selling anything off before shutdown happened, the week or two leading up to it, then those people knew something, you know? So if there was someone in the government that sold X amount of stock, they knew that come shutdown, there could be a run on that, right? And then go back a month before that or 2 months before that, anyone that was putting in, you know, shorts or calls, et cetera, at certain points and doing that in advance, follow the money, like they say. And it's the same thing if somebody's paying out ransomware. And there was a big article just recently about people saying that they're afraid that people are going to not report, and they're supposedly seeing this, but I don't know how you see it because people aren't reporting, that they're paying their ransomware if there could be penalties or fines because people aren't doing the due diligence to find out is this threat actor,
am I breaking OFAC?
Right.
By making this payment, yeah.
So I just found that really interesting. Like, I thought Black Hat did a good job of it. But Eric, to your point, it's hard to show like the buildup of the training, the tools, the years of experience. Like, how do you put that into a movie, right? and show like the 10 to 15 years that it took to get there. You know, it's almost like doing a documentary on like Steve Jobs. Like, how did he get to where he's at? You know, there's so many spans of that life, right? And that cycle of where he started and where he ended up. But the same is true, like for you guys with the computer experience and security, you know, where you started, the first time that you started to get your hands wet, all of a sudden this interest peaked, and now you're constantly engaging, researching, studying. And as you use the tools, you learn more, you adapt, but you also apply.
Spot on. But it comes back to, you got to be wired for it, right? Because once you get a taste, you don't want to go back.
Until you see Swordfish, and then you never want to watch another movie.
Well, yeah, fair enough. But I mean, I remember the turning point for me going the traditional IT route, that it was all, hey, you have a specification, I'm going to code something, I'm going to build something because we're trying to do some task. But then all of a sudden, I got the opportunity to go to a SANS class specifically on web application pen testing. And then you see the other side of it. Oh, dude, I can use what you built against you. I can break into it. Oh, that is cool. And then once you start going down that line of, you see, it's all of a sudden your view is open to all of the opportunities of things that you can break and do and all that. You know, and you talk about the draw, what draws us in, and it becomes an interesting question. And I get though why we're asked that question. I was just looking at some articles, and British Airways. Do you see the fine from the UK?
Oh, it was big. So you had the one, pounds, it was big.
So you had the one for GDPR that was, I think that was levied last year, and then just yesterday, 20 mil for that event.
And that's 20 million euros.
I would be
pounds. That it's sterling.
Or sorry.
Yeah, it should be sterling.
So in the US right now, the pound is a little depressed. So it's 1.25, I think. So 28 million US dollars.
But right there is why people are asking the question, why do you do what you do?
That's keep people from having to pay $28 million.
And so yeah, and that's one of the things that Dan and I were talking about earlier. It's fun to have the deck stacked against you, right? Think about it growing up playing sports. If you were to play on a sports team and you won every game handily, that's no fun. You're just going out there messing around, right? But when there's actual competition, when you're going knowing, hey, I got to put my best game face on, this is I guess it's kind of back to the Jordan Pippen kind of debate that we were having before. But when every day is a challenge, it's stacked against you, it's fun. There's something that just draws you in. I'm going to fight that battle. I'm going to fight that battle every day. And you've got to be, again, you got to be wired for it. But the whole incident response component of being, all right, I'm going to look, I'm going to dig in. Ooh, we got to figure out what they're doing, kind of recreating events, is a lot of fun. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a huge nerd.
Actually, what you're saying right there, this is funny, because if you go back, and I won't, actually, it's not funny. It's very, very realistic. If you go back 20 years ago, not even 20 years ago, and somebody said, you know, like there's the kids outside that were playing soccer together, right? And then there's the kid inside playing soccer via video game, right? Mm-hmm. And they'd say like, oh, well, he needs to get out more. He needs to be active, right? Like, you go out and be competitive. Right? Like, that's not being competitive. Now, I can jokingly look at it today and say, man, Eric, what you're talking about right there, like, yeah, I'd love to go out and play somebody in football and beat them. But now all I do is play fantasy football, and I get beat by somebody who's created a ton of different programs and has 2,000 different lineups going, right? Like, I could get better at this, right? And invest a little more money into it. But at the end of the day, that person that took the time to learn all these tools and everything else, you're not playing a game anymore. It really is warfare, right? Like, people are coming in and they're attacking computer systems, right? They're attacking networks. They're creating botnet armies, right? Like, and people are like, well, really, what is a botnet army? And I was trying to explain this, like the difference of being able to take millions and millions of IoT devices, your IoT device, and create a botnet army that can attack different telecoms and shut them down for a few hours or a day or 2 days, right? And they're like, are you being serious? I'm like, I'm being dead serious. I'm like, this, when somebody says there was a botnet attack or et cetera, right? Like, this is why you lost your your cell phone service and you were upset for an hour and a half because you couldn't text or, you know, put your new lineup in, right? That's what was going on behind the scenes. There was a war raging, right? But it's not the war that you're thinking of, where there's people actually like troops getting on the ground going after it. And some people would say that this started, like, who fired the first shot, right? And
right.
It goes back to the conversation when we were talking about Natanz and the number of years it took before they were able to actually fingerprint and say that maybe these two other countries were involved with creating almost a perfect weapon that you dropped on a nuclear enrichment site. And then once they saw that, I mean, you got to imagine those same countries were like, if they did it, we can do it. But nobody knows that sitting back watching their Disney movies and everything else. And all of a sudden they lose Wi-Fi, you know, and it's like, oh, well, it's the Russians, you know, we should blame them. You know, oh, North Korea, the Iran.
Hashtag.
You know, but nobody knows that maybe there was a shot fired from over here. It's not talked about.
Right.
It couldn't possibly.
It kind of gets back to the whole Orwell thing. We've always been at war with East Eurasia, right? That it's selling the headlines, though. But you're right. It is war games. I was just thinking of the quote, is it real or is it a game? What's the difference?
Should we dip in, since we're talking movies, should we dip into the one that started it all? War Games?
War Games it is.
War Games is the one that that really got me going. Like, this was the inspiration for me. Deep down, when I look back on it, this is where I first got the taste of, of playing around. And this is hacking as its old definition, or as its pure, its more pure definition, which is playing around, seeing what you find, testing, war dialing phone numbers, which, if you didn't know, that's how it got its name. The name of war dialing was from what he was doing in War Games. Prior to that, I don't believe it was called that, but just calling numbers in a row to see if modems answered.
Is that still a thing? I've got to imagine there's still modems out there.
Yes, there's absolutely modems out there. The internet is not the only thing. There's a lot of cellular fallback with cellular recall and landline modems that are still out there. And it's the ones they don't know about, like the ones that are just hanging off of a system that somebody forgot about, been there for 20 years, just powered on one of these awesome little external modems. Until somebody does a phone audit in an organization, you don't always know that they're there. The auditors have stopped asking for your war dialing records. Are you checking all of your phone numbers?
Right.
I imagine there's a lot out there. Well, I know in some organizations they definitely are out there.
And I guess technically that's evolved then too, because you could almost argue Shodan is almost war dialing on steroids as a business now.
It's misconfigured device war dialing,
which is Shodan is really cool. I mean,
what is Shodan for those that don't know, for those that may be listening that may not have played with it?
Yeah, so Shodan is an organization that is essentially, and I forget what the frequency is and how quickly they can go through the entire internet, but they're scanning the internet over and over again, finding new and more devices out there. And it creates kind of a catalog that you can search, that if you're looking for certain devices, and this was meant under the guise of being research. Let's see what's out there. Let's see what's going on. And now, as of recently, I know it's gone a little bit nefarious, because I believe there was just a service out there that, I forget if it was like $125 or whatever, you could sign up and they'd give you, hey, here's all the footage from webcams that were directly on the internet that have been stolen. So it gets a little creepy, but I think that throughout the history of evolution of technology, that has happened, right? That the intent to create something is usually good, and then a bad use case gets tacked on after the fact. And that's where we come in. The CISO Knights.
I just looked up Shodan real quick. 81% of the Fortune 100 use Shodan. Over 1,000+ universities use Shodan. Yeah. And it goes back to the idea of Google. My original slogan was, don't be evil. I don't see that anywhere on their website.
There's also enterprise versions of what Shodan does that are coming out, that are becoming productized of that kind of notion.
It even says here, get a competitive advantage, and it has a dollar bill next to it. So they have explore the Internet of Things, monitor network security, see the big picture. And then the last one is get a competitive advantage. Right. So it goes back to the idea, and Eric, I'm not saying this is bad, but it's the idea of all the different ways you can monetize data. It was a conversation I just had, and it was on the idea of monetization of data. We were talking about automotive, but here, one of the things here it says is get a competitive advantage. Who is using your product? Where are they located? Use Shodan to perform empirical market intelligence.
Sure.
And she goes, but how do we monetize that data? He goes, you know, Brian, the rules are kind of being set by the OEs, right? And I said, this is the biggest difference. I go between what people consider the tech industry, you know, the people, and I won't refer to myself, but the people working on this side for tech companies selling these SaaS products, security as a service, et cetera. You go in and talk to these companies and you're selling a license, right? But these suppliers that have worked in auto forever, they get beat up every day, you know, price, everything, their quality, every year given a reduction back as part of their APR. And he goes, how do you think we're ever going to convince them to let us keep some of this data? Right? Because there's, you look at the value stream, the autos know that this data is so important. And I said, well, why wouldn't you start the conversation with, we should really start sharing the data of our products like Rivian and Tesla's doing, the data of the components we're putting into the vehicle. Start there first. If you can start giving me real-time feedback on the components that I'm providing, right? Transmissions, the ECUs that go in. You know how many different computers, ECUs, electronic control units that are inside auto, the automobile, where if you could get real-time feedback, you could see different degradations as they're coming. And one of the reasons Tesla and Rivian are doing it is if you can actually see that, those different spikes within the battery system, you can shut down different cells to protect the degradation of the entire battery system, because there's a ton of money involved in that. But now let's go a little bit further. Let's talk about your braking systems, your gears, et cetera. You can actually see some of that wear. And I go, if you were able to give that back to the supplier, they too could improve their quality, reducing the warranty, saving the OE money. Start with how you're going to save them money and then figure out later what you can start to do with some of that data. And he goes, I think it's a double-edged sword on monetizing that data. There's so much data that's going to be coming from there. And I know I just switched gears, but on the monetization of data and looking up what Shogun did, it was like, all you start with the idea of don't be evil, right? Like this is for the good. And then all of a sudden you realize how important some of this data is that you're able to aggregate. And this is why there's hackers out there doing what they do. The data is very, very important.
Right. I feel like your argument is almost akin to the debate around open source versus closed source, right? The whole idea, well, if we open source it, if we share it with everybody, it's going to be to the betterment of everybody that it's got peer review. And it's kind of the same thing in the data, right? If we share the data with everybody, we're all going to win because we all have greater visibility into what's going on. And the end goal should be, well, I guess the ultimate winner is who? The consumer. Right? The consumer should win out. If you create a safer vehicle, a more efficient vehicle, you start to catch things before they break down. But kind of jumping back, because I feel like I've got to come in and defend Shodan in the Shodan versus Google analogy. I think where it's different though is Google, and I'm not knocking Google. I mean, they changed that whole space of searching. So kudos to them, right? They really revolutionized that. But what they then did is they generated net new data that I'm going to draw you into search by feeding you ads. And then I'm going to sell my own product and stuff like that. Shodan has just gone through, anybody can gather this information.
Right.
If we wanted to build our own computer system, and I think the University of Michigan does some of this as well, some of the scanning, we could go out and scan all of this. It's the public internet.
It's now a separate company, Census, but yeah.
Okay. But essentially all they've done is, all right, we're going to create a catalog and make it easier for you. So yes, you can monetize it because we're going to give you a plugin to go to data that's already out there. I'll just give you an easier interface to go through it. But the cool thing about it, as we looked at Shodan, one of the things that we use it for is we scan all of our egress points. So we've got our external addresses in there and it is great at picking up, hey, you've got a new device that just showed up. And it's kind of an early warning sign that, hey, somebody just put something on the internet that we need to look into. And if you use it as a security tool, as kind of it's a DVR for the internet, right? It's pretty powerful and they've done a good job. And they're not generating net new data by selling you or trying to get you into their service and doing evil. They're just giving you a better interface to what's already there.
But and I'm putting this on the table for a future episode because, boy, I want to talk more about War Games.
I was just going to say, too, I'd love everybody to know more about War Games, like, because it was made in 1983.
I just want to lay this down for a future episode, though. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Is it reckless to make all of this available in a format that's so easily accessible that it can be used for it can be used for other purposes? I think this is a future debate topic on, you know, do you make it open? Anybody can go do this, but you have to have a level of skill to be able to at least collect it. Do you make it so easy to get at that you're now putting other people at undue risk? Or is it informational and therefore beneficial to others enough that it is worth doing? Future episode. Subscribe in your podcast app, and then you can get it when it comes out. We don't know when we'll do it, but know that it's on the horizon. But subscribe
now. If this was video, I'd want to do the YouTube thing. Click up here to see more. Come back here. Subscribe here.
And click the bell.
Sorry, it's audio only.
Click the bell.
That's an interesting though one, because you're heading in that direction. You're heading into the ethical questions.
Absolutely.
And it's not only from a business, but if you think about it, as we've talked about young and upcomers in security. And one of the things that I preach to everybody that is up and coming in security is you have to have a strong ethical basis, because that is the difference between white hat, black hat. I mean, that I think that's oversimplifying it. And I had this conversation with somebody recently that was starting to play around with being able to do DAuth and get the encryption keys for wireless. I go, that's great. You want to learn what the technology is. Do not use it on your neighbor.
Yes.
That is a boundary.
Know where your own line is and what you will not cross. And when you come upon that line, you have to have a very, very difficult discussion with yourself.
Oh, 100%. And if you look at it, you know, if you go through all of the certifications that we all hold, each one of them have an ethics clause. And that was my point to them. If you get caught and are in breach of that, think of everything you've built up, all of the hard work that you've put in to learn all of these things, to gain all of these credentials. In one move, in one press of enter to launch that, you could undo all of that.
So, future episode, digital security and ethics.
Should we launch the new?
Not privacy drone 3 or 4 or 5, but rather ethical drone, something of that nature.
Dan, go back to War Games, though, because for anyone who hasn't seen it, the premise of the movie is actually very, very, very cool.
Do you want to play a game?
Yeah.
Well, it's exactly that. It's the basis of, and come on to another fun topic of mine, repeatable topic on mine, is that AI is not materially any further today than it was in 1984. It's self-teaching. We're no closer to a proper neural net than we were. What people call AI, artificial intelligence, is really just machine learning. Basis of the game, the basis of this. So the premise of War Games is there was a system, it's a military system, US DOD, that in it there was a scientist who had been building some self-learning engines through the game, through strategy games like Risk, Tic-Tac-Toe, and others, and using it to try and be able to predict when attacks would happen, to be able to automate the silos. So that people didn't have to have people make the judgment call of when to turn the key or not. It would just happen. And so the hacker Matthew Broderick finds an open modem and connects with this system that the DoD system, and he starts to interact with it and he starts to play around and look around. He's not trying to do anything nefarious. This is not about money. This is just about looking around. Hacking at its truest original definition. And once he starts to look around, he gets some idea about who created it, about the name of the system, and starts to interact with it. And this AI, this artificial intelligence, then starts to call him back. It starts to interact back with him and learns from the interaction, because it's taking all these inputs in to try and be a better predictor of both human nature. How would humans react in terms of global thermonuclear war? And at the end, it comes up, and then of course there's all the the Keystone Cops version of everybody trying to find him, and he makes pretend plane reservations to Paris. Were you going to escape? It's a good comedy on top of it all, but at its underlying, it's this is tech. This is humans interacting with technology, and at the end result, the only way to win the game is not to play at all. It's a very interesting, very interesting ethical outcome at the end of the movie. Highly, highly entertaining, great 1984 modem technology in which you have to place the handset on the coupler. For those of you who are under 21 and don't know what a handset is, I actually just learned this week, apparently hand signals are changing. You can't do the banana phone. You can't do the, the finger up, finger down, because kids now don't know what this means. To mean a telephone, they're using their full hand because it looks like a the meatloaf slab of your mobile phone.
Now I've got the song stuck in my head. Thank you. Banana ring, 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 banana phone.
This is a full service podcast. You get Eric singing and hand signals.
So it's
a movie on so many different dimensions. It's about interacting with technology. It's about AI, and I put in air quotes. It's about society. It's about ethics, and it's about technology. So
yeah, something for everybody.
Super fun movie. And it's appropriate for all ages.
I was going to say, and it's good for all ages. Now, another movie that most people wouldn't think of when it comes to the idea of cybersecurity and everything else, Imitation Game.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. And if you think about it, because I was just, what you were just saying, war, so that was the idea of trying to hack or figure out the code that the Germans were using, right? Enigma, and how to hack Enigma. And it was basically creating like a supercomputer, right, to try to break the code. And it wasn't until you found the right, if you want to call it, key, right, or keystroke that had to be put in, right? There was a certain number, you put that in every day, and then it would be able to read back to you, right?
Right. It was the cipher.
The cipher. And it kind of reminds me of, like, that in today, like that would be like a token, right? That you type in, boom, now you got full access. And that's basically what they got. They got the cipher, and then they had full access. And the years spent being able to do that, once they were able to do that, the number of lives that they were able to save because they were able to read the code, they had to make decisions. And for those that are listening, we're actually talking about the Imitation Game and the ability to build a super code or a supercomputer to try to break or hack into Enigma, right? And at the end of the day, it is hacking. You have these guys, and you're really trying, and you can think about it, trying to save the world, right? And there was the resources, there was people, the stress level, they were telling them, like, what you're doing is going to save millions of lives. And there was also other spies, right? So like you think about spy movies and the idea of CIA and KGB, like they did know that there was somebody that was sitting, in there that was working for the Russians. They did know that there was somebody that was working with the Americans. And at the end of the day, what information do you let out? You have to let a little bit out so they know what's going on. You have to still let a few bad things happen, but at the end of the day, you can save so many other troops, et cetera. Anyways, right. I throw that one out. I thought it was good. And then another one that comes.
That was a really good movie. And it's spot on to what we were talking about before. I mean, security is a war game, right?
Yeah.
Well, it is. And it's also about, comes back to managing risk. What you just described, Brian, there are some risks you do have to let go through so as not to disclose the forest for the trees, or win the battle or lose the battle so you can win the war. We're going to let this thing happen, even though we know about it. But sometimes you have to let that happen. Even in technology, we have to let certain things happen so we can glean more information and not disclose that we've got insight, so that they change the cipher or change the protection we built, and we lose the big picture.
Well, you get the same thing as well. The lessons learned from that, and you start to, as you decouple or decode, Stuxnet was kind of the same thing. We're not going to kill all of the enrichment capabilities all at once, just a little bit at a time. And then you kind of ramp it up.
Yeah. And when they get to the end, if you kill it in the beginning, they could fix this or see it early on. but you wait till it gets all the way to the end. So one centrifuge in the middle is being sped up. This one at the very end is being slowed down. And what you end up getting is a product that is useless. And right. over time, those centrifuges then end up breaking down their bearings. And in a year and a half, you end up replacing over 90% of your centrifuges, where the 3 years before you were replacing maybe less than 5%. Just sounds like you have a bad production of centrifuges. Yeah. In another movie I'm going to throw out, only because I really love Robert Redford, is the movie Spy Game, which I thought was super awesome. But you could also say Spy Game, although was more about literally the tit for tat, you know, between these spies, right, from all over the world. But the ability now, if you think about infrastructure, when they go in there, yes, they paid somebody off to go ahead and shut down the entire electrical grid of a peninsula so that the whole jail would shut down. But if you think about the idea of Stuxnet going after Natanz, this whole, you know, this is infrastructure, if you want to call it. There's been testing that's been done in Ukraine by the Russians, where they go after certain parts of the Ukraine to test new products or things that they've created to shut down infrastructure, power grids, et cetera. You could use that same stuff that they were doing there, like the movie Spy Game, to shut down the entire electrical grid for an operation to go in and save someone, right? How are we going to get in? Well, all we have to do, we've created this super bug. Go ahead and release. Boom. Everything shuts down. Next thing you know, you got Brad Pitt escaping. Some people call him handsome. And you got Robert Redford taking off in a Porsche 911. Woo. Anyways.
So the other thing that I've noticed as I'm thinking through these types of movies is there's also at the core of a lot of these types of movies is a social message, a social message of the day. If you think about things like the movie, remember the movie Antitrust? It was Tim Robbins as the Bill Gates-esque character. This was in the early 90s, early 2000s, right when Microsoft was having all of their antitrust problems. And so there was a social message around this, trying to, you know, work on the news of the day. One of the great ways to take these kind of, you know, technology is such a key part of life now that you, and for the last 30 years, using technology as an allegory for, you know, for the news of the day, or using the news of the day to convey a technology story, is becoming increasingly common. The other one is Office Space. When you use hacking as a way to get to an end result, and you look at the situations that the people were in Office Space and Cubicle Farms, and before perhaps the thing that drove some of our statewide partners to be able to convince people to go to Open Plan,
just fractions of a penny, Dan. Just fractions of a penny. It's just fractions of a penny that we're rounding off. That's right,
Superman. Superman this, too.
And I forgot about the movie Antitrust. It's funny because I do remember seeing it, but it was so elaborate, like, and everything that there, who was who and who was bad, who was good. Even the girlfriend was a plant, and they were stealing
Claire
code
Forlani,
from. Yeah, they were stealing code from around the world. I actually forgot about that movie.
It's a good one. It's one of those guilty pleasure movies. I enjoy watching it. Now I think it's really interesting, and it does make you remember back to that era and what the problems were we were dealing with. We were dealing with a single company that had lots of control. Wait, stop me if you've heard this, or stop me if this sounds familiar.
it's like the movie The Circle with Tom Hanks.
Yes.
Which was kind of another one where it's like, and it's funny because, why did you name the movie The Circle? You know, what company just built a headquarters that's a giant circle?
Any correlation to events real events is purely coincidental. I'm trying to think of some other ones that had those social components to it.
I just tried to pull up a list, you know, thinking about this. There's, if you go back to like 1975, 3 Days of the Condor, and it's Robert Redford again, CIA codebreaker, tries to figure out why his own agency wants him dead. And of course, the year before that was Gene Hackman, also somebody I really like, in the movie The Conversation, where he plays the surveillance expert using high-tech equipment back then high-tech equipment to spy on a couple that he fears may be in danger. And that was nominated for 3 Oscars, by the way. So that's taking it way back. And I know a lot of our listeners are probably not going to go back and watch something made in 1975, but there was a movie called The Net with Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock?
Yeah.
I use that as my one of my low watermark movies. Mozart's Ghost.
But like, if you were to say like what's your entry point into cybersecurity, you know, and Eric, you were just talking about, you know, you took a SANS course. I wouldn't say that's the entry point for most people, right? You come in, you get your first experience maybe at home doing something, and you begin to play with some code, and then you get a job as maybe just an analyst, et cetera. And next thing you know, 2 years later, you're at SANS, right? What's the entry level movie-wise? I would say The Net is kind of like an entry level, you know, cybersecurity movie, right? It's that first taste of seeing what somebody can do, this conspiracy, this person goes on a vacation and, you know, someone's trying to kill her because she has this secret code. And anyways, I just throw that one out. But Sneakers, I think, is an all-time great. And I know
we Sneakers talked about and War Games. I think those are two of the classic pinpoints that people go back to.
Although I'll jump one earlier than that, and that's Tron.
Ah, yeah. Fair point.
Oh,
Tron,
yeah.
1982. That was another one that just was, you know, so key to defining. Maybe these were the movies that defined this generation, my generation. You know, we were young and impressionable and watching movies, and I think it really added to the idea that technology was something we could do that was right. You know, becoming more and more accessible.
And let's not forget Jurassic Park. Come on, I got to throw that one out. Didn't say the magic word.
You know what I didn't think
Newman
about?
Said, Newman, no, Newman. Nedry. Dennis Nedry says you can't do
Cloak and Dagger. Do you remember Cloak and Dagger?
I don't think I've seen that.
Don't know that I do. So, describe.
So I saw War Games well after I saw Cloak and Dagger. And I Cloak and Dagger was the Atari video game. You know, the kid playing Atari. And Davey sees this. It's like a ghost that always talks to him. Go back and watch Cloak and Dagger. But it's literally about. He works at like a little video game shop, and he finds inside this video game some code, right? And these terrorists or secret agents are trying to get their hands on this video game, and it's a game of Cloak and Dagger and him hiding and getting the game to the right people. And is the FBI agent really an FBI agent, or is he one of the bad guys, right? And there's the ending of the scene takes place in San Antonio on the Riverwalk. And I'll always remember this because as a little kid, I was told that by my parents. And when we went down to San Antonio, like that's the spot I wanted to go. But it was so much different because it was in the daytime, not at night, super creepy. Like, I'm like, oh, this doesn't look that scary in the movie. I was like freaked out about this one scene. Anyways, I digress. Cloak and Dagger was a good one, but I didn't even think of it as kind of a hacker movie. But it's another one of those that there's, again, a kid finds code inside a game, right? And I just always thought like those kids were just a lot smarter at video games than I was.
Right.
And now we're 30 years or 30 plus years past all of that. And Ready Player One comes out a couple of years ago. Have you guys seen Ready Player One?
Yep.
Yeah.
Did you read the book first or did you watch the movie?
Movie first.
I watched book the movie first.
Far exceeds the movie. I mean, the movie was good, but the book was awesome.
It's usually the case.
Yeah, oftentimes the case. But so you've been seeing this now. Ready Player Two, I think, is now the book is now written and will come out shortly. So you've got this just continuum of technology and movies and how technology is impacting life. All of it comes together to tell us that, you know, these are inseparable things. I'll be really interested to see what the movies of today do to encourage the professionals of tomorrow and going into these spaces. Because if you look, security, whereas there was movies about security, there was movies about protection in the 80s and 90s. Now it's weaved into all technology movies. It's part of the core of everything, access and you know, and evasion and hiding and detecting. All of these are just part of every piece of technology movie, up to and including The Matrix.
Right. Well, that's kind of been the story all along, right? That movies kind of drive some of innovation. If you look back at Star Trek and some of those things, mm-hmm. the components that were in there, that you got a bunch of cult followers around it. I don't know, cult followers is the right term, but nonetheless,
very passionate fans.
There you go. But nonetheless, you had technologies that were created or shown in there that have now somewhat come to fruition. And
mm-hmm. sci-fi has long been the visionary for the future.
I've yet to see the tricorder
I have in my hands.
Right, absolutely. Yet to see weird science play out though. In real world, and bringing somebody back to life, or creating a person,
getting Oingo Boingo to re-record to re-release any of their music.
Remember the movie Eagle Eye, though. I mean, that was the one with I'm going to butcher his name if I say it out loud, but that was the super government computer that was gathering information from every source. Right? It kind of reminds you of.
Oh yeah, Shia LaBeouf.
Yes, Shia LaBeouf, and literally, this computer is able to make, you know, power surges so that a electrical cord breaks and comes whipping down at the right time to hit someone and electrocute them. You know what I mean? You're gathering information from sensors from everywhere, video cameras, the number of things that it was able to do just because it was able to gather all of that data, right? That some government computer that they had created, and it was his twin brother who worked there that was helping create the programming. And ultimately the computer decided that it was the people, right? Just like in the movie War Game, right? Where it was the people, you just got to stop playing the game. And it believed that the threat to the world was actually some of these politicians and these people in the military were the real threat. So it was figuring out how to kill them all. And it was using all this information, right? And really, a lot of times what hackers and threat actors that are going after data for ransom to make money, right, is kind of the same thing that Eagle Eye was doing, gathering all this data, right, and trying to determine in its head, from a war game standpoint, who is good and who is bad. But it was the determining factor, meaning Eagle Eye, this giant machine, and I guess at the end, it was a giant computer with this eagle eye kind of robot that kind of went around. And anyways. Right.
Well, I mean, it kind of gets into that as you step into a more recent one, Die Hard, right? And I forget what the actual name of the latest Die Hard one where you start holding.
Live it's Free or Die Hard.
Is that the one with the hacker that essentially kind of holds the government ransom, opening up pipelines and some of that stuff. And, you know, while that makes a great movie, it's not too far off from the truth, right? It's not too far where we have to go back. And if we think about the Russians getting into a dam in, I believe it was upstate New York, right? And it just happens that luckily the dam was offline for maintenance, but that could have been a catastrophe.
And I hate to say this, Eric, I do agree with you. It would fall into that. In my cybercrime magazine cybercrime movies dating back to the 60s, it doesn't include Die Hard. I feel like they have a thing against Bruce Willis here. I might have to write them.
That, yeah. Well, it's also the debate. Let's not forget Die Hard is the original, is a Christmas movie.
It is a Christmas movie.
Absolutely is a Christmas movie.
Absolutely. With Severus Snape, starring Severus Snape and David from Moonlighting.
I was gonna mention one thing since I mentioned Stuxnet earlier. Anybody who wants to dive deeper into that, and I don't know if you guys have read it or not, but Countdown to Zero Day is phenomenal.
Yeah,
it is such a long book, but the details that it gets into around Stuxnet, how it was found out, how it was built, it's awesome.
I recommend in that order, Countdown to Zero Days, and then read The Perfect Weapon, because The Perfect Weapon kind of starts talking about before Stuxnet and then after Stuxnet, but there's a good portion in the middle about Stuxnet and why it was a perfect weapon. But then it goes to talk about all the different types of weaponized cyber crime that you're seeing in what nation states are doing, but countdown to 0 days gives you some very, very interesting kind of deep dive, right, into the different companies and the people that were originally deciphering the code. And even when you talk about Ndugu and Flame, right, which at the end of the day, some people say one of those may have been used before Stuxnet as kind of like a research tool to go out and investigate, and the other one was maybe after Stuxnet, but in how dangerous those two were as well, right? In the information that was being gathered from countries that might have been allies of ours. And I'm not saying it was the Americans that did it. I'm just saying there was information being gathered, and I think some people could definitely point a finger and say
lines could be drawn.
Yeah.
Brian, can you rewind about 3 minutes and tell listeners what Stuxnet is?
Yeah, so if you, let's say Stuxnet would have been, and I'm going to put this into my own words, when someone says the perfect weapon, Stuxnet was a line of code or software that was delivered, which most people think by some type of memory stick, into a facility in Iran. And what Stuxnet was a weapon of code that had 5 0-days embedded into it. And when we use the word 0 days, when someone says countdown to 0 days, a 0-day is when that type of, Eric, help me out here. It's the 0-day refers to the moment at which a threat is known. In a 0-day is completely unknown in the wild until that moment. So nobody knows about it. 0 days are considered like the worst thing that could happen to you as a cybersecurity analyst, threat responder, et cetera. They say that 1 0-day today on the market could be worth $50,000 to $100,000. If you had two combined together, you could probably get $1 million. Now imagine if you built something that had 5 0-days embedded into it. It took researchers years to break down Stuxnet through all the different 0-days in the code that was combined together, right? So we're talking, when they say a perfect weapon, the fact that it had 5 0-days is why most people point to a government in terms of, to build something like that, the amount of funding and people needed, and when you say resources combined together, that's what made Stuxnet such a powerful / perfect weapon.
And as you fast forward, I think it gave it further credence as we start looking at what happened with Shadow Brokers, Eternal Blue, and all of those, the NSA exploits that came out, thus creating WannaCry, which, similar to Stuxnet, Stuxnet was highly targeted, had a purpose. It had to get into an air gap network. So an air gap network is one that's not connected to the internet. It's a standalone IT system that, you know, as Brian mentioned, the USB drive, that you have to take it from an online system and move it to the offline system. Still a computer system, but not connected to anything else. So it's its own contained silo. But if you look at, as you get into the book, Stuxnet, the reason we found out about it is it got out into the wild and got around. Well, that was the same thing that happened with WannaCry, right? I don't know if it was really intended to be a mass weapon as it ended up being. It was highly targeted. And I can't remember what country it was targeted at. Was that Ukraine?
Say that again.
So WannaCry was targeted. So WannaCry was built off of Eternal Blue and some of the things that came out from Shadow Brokers. So if we go back, Shadow Brokers was a group that, and Dan, I can't remember exactly, but I believe they found a server that supposedly had a bunch of exploits that the NSA were playing with, that they had been hoarding and using to get in and out of systems, found that. And then you could sign up for Shadow Brokers, and they were releasing a little at the time. Well, Eternal Blue was massive. And very quickly, it got built into WannaCry, that when released, it wormed its way around the internet and took out some big companies. I mean, it was bad.
I was trying to look that up too, who WannaCry was first targeting. But you're absolutely right in terms of, Eternal Blue was stolen and leaked by the group called the Shadow Brokers. And this would make a really good movie too, because WannaCry, similar to Stuxnet, got out into the wild, but Stuxnet would only become operational if there was a Siemens PLC, two different versions, and right. also a certain number of endpoints, desktops or laptops. I think it was like 136 combined together with it, or 142, some number like that. And it was believed that that would only occur in one place in the world, and that would be in Natanz. Well, fast forward years later, and there's two other scenarios that played out, one being a very large gas pipe that blew up in northern Russia that apparently some sensor failed and the pressure built up, right? So it's just like the idea of the centrifuge is spinning too slow or too fast. It was saying that the pressure was fine as it was building up, and it blew up and caused a mushroom cloud similar to Hiroshima. And everybody said, oh, it was a failed. I mean, if you read the news articles, it was a failed sensor, a pressure system. And it's lo and behold, there was a certain Siemens Step 7 PLC attached to it. And I think if you go back even further, it had this right number of computers attached to it, but it just so happened, you know, and that will happen. You say, well, that's a one in a million shot. Well, there's enough systems out there that a one in a million shot could occur, and it affected every Siemens. And that's why I compared it when I wrote my article. I wrote my first kind of LinkedIn publication on COVID and explaining the idea of COVID-19 and how it was very similar to Stuxnet. The idea that all you needed to bridge the gap for the protein synthesis to occur was furin. And furin is found in every human body, right? So the idea for it to become operational, it was going to get in and become operational or infect everyone. But would it kill everyone? No, there were certain things, but at that time, underlying things that even I didn't know. I was looking at it more from a scientific approach, comparing it to Stuxnet. And one thing I will say, and I know we're wrapping up here, Eric, I totally agree. People need to read the book, Countdown to Zero Days. My brother makes fun of me whenever I bring up Stuxnet, and he'll say, did you just talk about Sputnik again? And I'm like, no, it's Stuxnet. But read the book, because the movie's coming out on HBO, the documentary movie on Stuxnet, and it's the perfect weapon. And I'm kind of super stoked to watch it, only because I've already read the book and I've already read Countdown to Zero Days as well, which reflects on the perfect weapon, which the movie is about, the documentary. So I'm hoping that the documentary lives up to the hype of what I took from the book, because I could go back and read that one again. And I can't take full credit for finding the book on my own. It was Chris Burrows who got up and recommended it at a conference like a year ago. And I wrote it down, and it took me a few weeks before I even looked it up. But the second I got even into like the introduction of it, I was hooked. It was like we're talking about today, some of these movies, you don't even have to be in security to get hooked, right? Like the premise behind it, you're like, oh wow, that's really interesting. And this is about a true story about something that really happened in the wild. And it is about the idea of a perfect weapon. So I challenge people to either, if you don't want to read the book because it's too much science or data for you, fine. But when you watch the movie, I'd go back and say, read the book to really get a deep dive to understand why we're where we're at today in terms of cybersecurity.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. This is really good stuff. I want to close with one question, though. Let's take out the easy ones. War games, hackers, The Matrix. What is your favorite hacking or tech movie?
Yeah, I'm gonna rock with Live Free or Die Hard. I thought that was good. I was originally gonna say Jurassic Park, just because I think nobody looks at Jurassic Park and goes, oh, that's not a cyber movie. But if you think about it, that's similar to ransomware. They got locked out, and what happens? Domino effect. They couldn't get back into the systems, and everything fell over. But Live Free or Die Hard, you think about it, that you've got a highly motivated, highly technical cyber expert that, hey, I told you this was possible. You didn't believe me. You didn't want to listen. I'm going to show you how real this really was. Now, granted, I think they took it to maybe a little extreme lengths, but nonetheless, I thought from a cyber perspective, it's eye-opening, and it starts to beg some questions on what's possible specifically on critical infrastructure.
Nice. How are you, Brian?
Ooh.
You can pick only one.
Oh, you know, watching The Great Hack recently, but it's not a movie. You know what I mean? That's more of a documentary.
Right.
Especially as we get ready for voting season here. But if you were to say movie that's not based on historical, you know, a documentary.
It could be whatever. It could be whatever you want. Just not The Matrix, Hackers, or War Games.
Not The Matrix. It would have to be Sneakers. Sneakers was a great movie. And at the end of the day, like, it's one that you could watch with the entire family. And even if you didn't know it had to do with hacking, you still thought it was super cool, right? And it kind of had the feel of the original Hackers with Angelina Jolie and those guys riding around on skateboards, because you had like this bad guy, right, with the long hair, and he kind of rode around on a skateboard inside this facility. I don't know. I would definitely throw that one out there. That would be the one I go with.
Absolutely. And mine, I'm going with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, because the whole day was enabled by the fact that he asked for a car, he got a computer, thought that was being, that he was born under a bad sign, but he used it to enable the whole day, to enable his whole adventure by being able to reduce his, he hacked in and got to the school grades, attendance computer, and reduced his numbers of days off.
Great choice.
The other one I'll put out there that we haven't talked about is Real Genius. Real Genius, not a hacking movie, it's a physics and laser movie, but the outcome of the whole movie is based upon hacking in, chip hacking, actually, you know, chip replacements, whole different type of thing. And if you haven't seen any of those, go get them. I'm going to attempt to put all of these into the show notes.
One more, Enemy of the State, I thought was really good too. And we glossed over that one.
Yeah, definitely. That's, definitely. Oh,
Gene Hackman.
I don't know. Brian mentioning Sneakers. I couldn't let the line go. There's a war out there, old friend, a world war. And it's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information. What we see and hear, how we work, what we think, it's all about the information. So true.
No more secrets. SeaTac astronomy.
And by the way, there was a prison inmate in Michigan that used hacking to get himself released, or tried to get himself released. And I'll try to find the article and share you guys. This was, I want to say, like a year ago. And somebody shared it with me after, I don't know, we did one of our podcasts and I forgot to bring it up. And I was like, that is very interesting. He found out who his guards were, and with the ability to use a computer here and there, he was a hacker, and he found a way to send them emails constantly till one of them clicked on something, phishing email, and was able to backtrack all the way into the systems to go ahead and get himself released from prison.
I love it. That's great. Eric, Brian, thank you once again. Another great movie debate today. I appreciate all the great insights. I now have to go rewatch just about every one of these, so I may not see my wife or kid for like at least 6 weeks. Thank you for listening. If you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. Or if you have topics for future shows, well, actually, send us your favorite hacking and technology movie. Send it in, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. The website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net. And you can find the podcast in any of your favorite podcast applications. Just go there, hit subscribe, click the little bell. No, this isn't YouTube. And please subscribe and keep listening. You can find us on Twitter as well, @securitydebate. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time for another great security debate.